This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are now having, and we had, some default that actually happened. We have Zambia, we have Ghana, more or less Ethiopia on the brink, and this is the dynamic within which we are now.
That was Cameroonian financier Alain Nkonchu on the growing inability of African countries to repay loans. Details coming up. Also, at least 15 people were killed and dozens injured when a pickup truck plowed into a crowd in the U.S. city of New Orleans. And raids by ADF rebels killed at least 12 people in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, says authorities are exercising search warrants in New Orleans and areas outside the southern U.S. state of Louisiana as part of their investigation into a deadly New Year's Day attack in the city's popular French Quarter. At least 15 people were killed and at least 30 others injured when a driver crashed a pickup truck into a crowd of New Year's revelers at the intersection of New Orleans' famous Canal and Bourbon Streets, which are filled with numerous bars and live music venues. Authorities say the driver got out after the crash and opened fire on police, who returned fire and killed the suspect. Two officers were wounded. The FBI says weapons and a possible explosive device were found in the vehicle, while other possible explosive devices were found elsewhere in the French Quarter. The suspect has been identified as 42-year-old Shamsuddin Jabbar. President Joe Biden said yesterday that Jabbar was a Texas-born American who served for several years in the U.S. Army in both active duty and in the reserves. Biden said the FBI reported that Jabbar posted videos on social media hours before the attack that he was inspired by Islamic State militant group to kill. The Islamic State flag was found in his vehicle. The FBI said it is investigating the attack as an act of terrorism and that authorities do not believe the driver acted alone. Nolan Hayes, who is from New Orleans, is a political scientist at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a member of an international security advisory board. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that she has been warning of increased terror threats inside the U.S. and elsewhere for some time. She starts with the impact of the attack on New Orleans.
So mostly what you're going to find, especially in the French Quarter, especially on Bourbon Street, are tourists. You're going to find young folks. And so far, unfortunately, the information that we're getting, the names that we're getting so far, they are young folks. And so far, they are tourists. And that's what's so unfortunate about this situation. And then also another point is there are people who actually prefer to go to New Orleans for New Year's versus, say, a Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras might be too overwhelming. You know, New Year's Eve could be something a little bit more reasonable. I love New Orleans, actually, for New Year's Eve for that reason, because it's more manageable than Mardi Gras or Essence Fest, Jazz Fest. And so I'm just heartbroken. I'm heartbroken for the victims and their families, my city. We have been through so much. And I just, waking up to this news was just awful and horrendous.
And when you say that, I know you're not saying it, but you're thinking about Hurricane Katrina, too, in the aftermath.
I am thinking about Katrina and everything that's happened since then, you know, the spikes in violence, you know, and the way that a lot of Native folks have transitioned out of the city. I mean, you know, sometimes I go home and I don't recognize it, sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, you know, but New Orleans has not been the same since Katrina. And I don't know what this is going to do to tourism. People just simply might be afraid to be in open areas where they can be victimized in this sort of brutal and horrific way.
As somebody who monitors terror threats in this country, in Africa, and elsewhere. You sit on an international panel that does that. What are your thoughts on the attacker who authorities say may have had contact with terrorist groups?
I mean, listen, the awful truth is that if global terrorism is spiking, it's not hard to imagine that domestic terrorism is also spiking. In fact, last year, the FBI issued a warning about that very fact. And I tried my best to warn people that, hey, listen, if this is something the FBI is keeping an eye on and they're going public about it, this is very serious. And we saw what just happened in Germany. The fact that, you know, ISIS is trying to take advantage of the power vacuum in Syria, you know, they have strongholds in at least 4 to 6 countries in Africa. And the fact that they may have some homegrown or some radicalized folks here in the United States does not surprise me.
That was Nola Haynes, political scientist at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a member of an international security advisory board. She was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Entering 2025, at least 20 African countries are bankrupt or at high risk of defaulting on debt repayments, according to global financial institutions. The reasons for this, says economists, include the COVID-19 pandemic, global conflict, soaring inflation, climate change, and corruption. Darren Taylor reports.
A recent United Nations report unpacks how Africa's debt challenges are retarding its development, preventing it from spending adequately on health, education, and infrastructure. The World Bank says Africa's external debt has climbed to more than $650 billion, and debt servicing costs reached nearly $90 billion in 2024. In 2025, according to the bank, the continent will be expected to pay almost $100 billion to external creditors, including the International Monetary Fund, the United States, France, and Germany, and private lenders spread across the globe. Then there's China, by far the biggest holder of African debt. The UN says the continent owes China's public and private lenders around $85 billion. Angola alone, it says, owes Chinese lenders $21 billion, with Kenya and Ethiopia each owing China almost $7 billion. UN Development Programme Chief Economist Raymond Gilpin says African countries pay more to borrow because ratings agencies label them high risk, often without proper analysis.
When this is not done, the cost to African countries in terms of higher interest rates and also in terms of lower development financing inflows for the 19 countries we surveyed came up to about $74 billion. That's more than the total amount of aid that African countries receive on an annual basis. You look at the interest rates that African countries, some of the poorest in the world, pay about 12% on average, while the developed world interest rate is about 3%. Today, over 700 million Africans live in countries that pay more in terms of debt servicing than they pay in terms of investing in health and education. Bottom line here is that countries that could afford it less are paying much more, and that doesn't seem right.
Gilpin was speaking at a live virtual event at Oxford University earlier this month. At the same event, Cameroonian financier Alain Nkonchu said African countries cannot afford to repay loans at the exorbitant interest rates international lenders demand.
We are now having, and we had, some default that actually happened. We have Zambia, we have Ghana, more or less Ethiopia on the brink, and this is the dynamic within which we are now. And the question has been for most of the country the ability to roll over that debt as opposed to basically defaulting. The NEPSOC has gone to a level where we understand that the ability to withstand the shock is pretty limited, as you can see. And yet,
in 2020, Zambia became the first African country to declare itself bankrupt. Mali said it was insolvent in 2022 and remains unable to service a large part of its debt. Also in 2022, Ghana came close to bankruptcy and still owes creditors $45 billion. Other countries that will struggle to make payments in 2025, according to global financial institutions, include Angola, Chad, Ethiopia, Malawi, Mozambique, and Kenya. Gilpin says Africa's cycle of underdevelopment will continue unless the international financial structure is reformed. These reforms, he suggests, must enable multilateral development banks to offer long-term predictable financing at affordable rates to African nations. The UN says Africa is currently marginalized in global financial decision-making. This should be partly addressed, it says, by giving the continent stronger voting rights at institutions such as the IMF. The UN also proposes that African countries pay debt at reduced rates and that in some cases debt be written off. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Yeheyes Wuhib, in Washington. Nigerian authorities plan to convert 1 million gasoline engine vehicles to run on cheaper, cleaner compressed natural gas, or CNG, by the year 2027. Nigeria has some of the largest gas reserves in the world, but with only a few CNG filling stations available in the country, many who have converted their vehicles are facing a new challenge. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Vehicles stretching hundreds of meters in line for gasoline is not unusual in Nigeria, but this is different. Here, desperate commuters are hoping to get compressed natural gas at one of the few centers dispensing CNG across the country. Some, like Yahya Ibrahim, have been here grounded for 5 days.
We dropped load for Katsina.
After I dropped off my load in Katsina State, I came here because the remaining gas will not take me back to Kogi State, where I came from.
Taxi driver Abdullahi Ashiru converted his vehicle 3 months ago and spends only a third of his daily gasoline budget to run on natural gas. But he says the struggle to get CNG lately has been frustrating.
I've been here since, let's say, since 11 o'clock. See, now what is time now? At least I think to four, I'm buying CNG.
Nigeria has the largest gas reserves in Africa, about 209 trillion cubic feet. And last year, shortly after scrapping gasoline subsidies, the government launched a robust natural gas transition initiative, including a plan to have 1 million CNG-powered vehicles on the roads in 3 years. Natural gas is a cheaper and cleaner fueling alternative for Nigerians. Gasoline prices have increased about sixfold since the government scrapped its subsidy program last year, making more people eager to switch to natural gas. There are currently about 130 conversion centers, and authorities aim to establish hundreds more across the country by 2027. But many, like Abuja resident Omotayo James, say there's no need if CNG cannot be readily available.
At least we should have like 7 points in Abuja that is working only on him before you start conversing for conversion. This is a federal road. This is a road that leads to airport. I don't know how Asu Adibola Ahmed want to go to airport and they want to stop car and they are seeing people on the road like this.
Last month, the government announced a plan to raise $250 million by 2027 to support CNG infrastructure development. But many say that intervention can come soon enough. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And according to a French news agency AFP report yesterday, raids by fighters with the ADF rebels killed at least 12 people in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The attacks followed a series of raids by the ADF, which has been linked to the Islamic State group that killed 21 people in North Kivu province over the Christmas period. Local officials say the new attacks overnight, Tuesday to Wednesday, targeted two places in the same province. The Camp David Accords, signed by U.S. President Jimmy Carter, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin in September 1978, established a framework for a historic peace treaty concluded between Israel and Egypt in March 1979. President Carter and the U.S. government played leading roles in creating the opportunity for this agreement to occur. Saeed Sadiq, professor of political sociology at Egypt-Japan University, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the vital role of the late president in reaching this agreement and his commitment to peace.
Until 1979, there was no peace between the Arabs and the Israelis, only ceasefires and truce. The two sides were incapable on their own reaching any peace agreement. What was needed is a strong, trusted third party who was willing to put influence, put his power and time to bring the two sides together. Carter was the one who broke this endless cycle of perpetual conflict. Carter was also lucky that two strong leaders were willing to break this chronic conflict. His involvement, you know, can be assessed through several key aspects. His personal commitment to peace, his diplomatic skills, the framework development that was offered. He also used the U.S. leverage as a mediator on both Israel and Egypt. He had a long-term vision that the only way to reach peace in the Middle East and also protect human rights is reaching a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. And that also was important when he reached the Camp David Accord, and that became the cornerstone of future peace processes afterwards.
The Camp David summit, held from September 5 to September 17, 1978, was a pivotal moment both in the history of the Arab-Israeli dispute and U.S. diplomacy. Rarely had a U.S. president devoted as much sustained attention to a single foreign policy issue as Carter did over the summit's two-week duration. How do you explain Carter's unique commitment to peace in the Middle East?
He had personal beliefs and value. He had been influenced by his Southern Baptist faith, which emphasized moral responsibility, justice, and the importance of peace. It was also the historical context. The Arab-Israeli conflict at that time had been a long-standing issue with significant geopolitical implications for the U.S. And Carter recognized that resolving this conflict could lead to greater stability in the Middle East, particularly oil supplies, the Cold War dynamic. He also wanted a legacy. He was a new president. He was personally engaged in this endeavor. He had personal relations with Israeli Prime Minister Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, spending long hours negotiating details, building personal relationship and trust between them. He was also lucky in getting bipartisan support in the Congress. Both the Republican and Democrat supported this peace initiative and endeavor by President Carter, and that's why it survived.
After the signing of the Camp David Accords in March of 1979, the issue wouldn't receive the same level of U.S. attention due to the competing demands of crisis, especially those in Iran and Afghanistan, as well as Carter's desire to reduce his personal involvement in the next round of negotiations devoted to Palestinian autonomy. How did that impact the Israeli-Palestinian conflict afterwards?
As you know, since Carter bet regarding the peace between Egypt and Israel, successive American president did not invest the same amount of energy and effort in reaching peace treaty with other parties. So the peace process was stalled. There was increased tension in the area. And there was a shift in regional dynamics. America began to be very busy with Iran, Afghanistan, Russian invasion of Afghanistan. And so it had long-term consequences. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict began to be sidelined. American foreign policy in the Middle East began to shift on other issues like Iraq invasion of Kuwait and occupation of Iraq in 2003, the problem of the Iranian nuclear program. Other issues began to take over and take precedence and take prime stage while the Palestinian-Israeli conflict receded, not only from the American foreign policy, but even from regional players. I have 57 Muslim countries, 22 Arab countries. None of them saved the Palestinians in Gaza. So I cannot blame only the Americans, but they always play a big role in reaching peace. I mean, if they had done their bit like President Carter and invested, maybe we would not have seen 7th of October 2023. We would not have seen any of this conflict.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at Egypt-Japan University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Carter died on December 29th at the age of 100. He served just one term as president from 1977 to 1981 and then went on to focus on humanitarian causes and advancing democracy worldwide. His state funeral will be next week here in Washington, D.C. You can find more on Carter's legacy, including his efforts to eliminate guinea worm disease, on voaafrica.com, voanews.com, and on your favorite social media. President-elect Donald Trump made immigration a key focus of his 2024 presidential campaign. His incoming administration is planning stricter enforcement. VOA immigration correspondent Alien Barros explains what these policies might mean.
In his presidential campaign, Donald Trump promised stricter border measures, including greater detention and deportation of undocumented immigrants.
We're going to end up with the largest deportation in American history. We have no choice. Have no choice, right? Have no choice. We have no choice because that's not sustainable by any country.
Possible Trump plans include expanded detention facilities and a return to the Remain in Mexico policy, requiring migrants to stay in Mexico during U.S. immigration proceedings. Trump's pick for border czar, Tom Holman, says tougher enforcement will focus on improving public safety and national security.
The heels of the biggest illegal immigration crisis we've ever seen in this nation, there has to be a massive deportation operation.
Some immigration experts say mass deportations weaken public safety by discouraging immigrants from reporting crimes. David Beer is the director of immigration studies at the Cato Institute.
Immigrants are more likely than the average U.S.-born person to report crimes to the police. But studies have repeatedly shown that when indiscriminate enforcement increases in an area, that reduces that already high rate of crime reporting or higher rate of crime reporting among immigrants.
If migrants do not have criminal records, Democratic and Republican administrations have generally released them while they await immigration hearings. That may end with the incoming administration considering mandatory detention. Immigration attorney David Leopold.
If I were a lawful permanent resident, a green card holder, I'd be sure to have my green card on my person now.
Trump officials argue that these measures will deter criminals, but Beer found that was not what happened last time.
Mass deportation is going to deprioritize serious offenders. When the Trump administration came in last time, they rescinded all the requirements to focus on serious offenders, felons first, and as a result, not surprisingly, ICE doubled the number of arrests of non-criminals.
Meanwhile, he says the number of criminals found attempting to cross the border tripled. Trump says he will act on immigration on day one of his presidency, January 20th. Alini Barros, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Swuhib in Washington. on behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.